From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Verlot, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and welcome to Worldviews. Rebecca Cruz is in Italy for the rest of May, so I'm joined by University of Oklahoma political economist Mitchell Smith. We'll talk about the Eurozone's economy slipping further into recession and the American kicked out of Russia over accusations of spying for the CIA.
It will probably be a very long time before we really know, and in fact, we will have long forgotten this by the time we really know what's going on here.
And later, veteran diplomat Richard Arndt joins us for a conversation about how the national security state changed U.S. diplomatic relations.
There was a time when we said, we have to build the most beautiful embassies we can build. But today they're fortresses.
He's the author of The First Resort of Kings, American Cultural Diplomacy in the 20th Century. But first, this hour's news. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Rolat. Professor Mitchell Smith, Chair of the Department of International and Area Studies and Director of the European Union Center, thank you for joining me today for the roundtable.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm happy to be here.
So some interesting news headlines this week. An American official in Moscow was detained and eventually kicked out of Russia after allegedly trying to recruit a Russian security officer as a spy. Now, there's nothing new here, right, Mitchell? I mean, spying, we spy, everybody spies. There's a long history of spying between these two countries. So why is this such big news this week?
Well, I think it's the story itself is fascinating. The details of it have taken on what seems to be a sort of comical nature that really give it an element of intrigue and have led to a whole bunch of theories about what may or may not be going on here.
I mean, I think what's really interesting is kind of the low-tech nature of what he was caught with, right? Some kind of really cheap wigs, quite a lot of cash, you know, a map, a compass, a pocket knife, you know, an old version of a cell phone. So nothing high tech. I mean, are we really to believe that this man was seriously trying to recruit a spy with this kind of low tech gear?
Right. It seems
himself?
Like a sort of a mail order spy kit from the 1950s or somewhere in that period. You know, it's hard to say exactly what's going on. I think it will probably be a very long time before we really know. And in fact, we will have long forgotten this by the time we really know what's going on here. But, you know, I think anything is possible from the possibility that he was, in fact, a spy trying to recruit somebody to the fact that he was, may have been planted by the Russian security services. Or there's also a hypothesis that he went rogue in pursuit of a possible lead and just really miscalculated.
Well, I think it is interesting that some have come out to defend the fact that he was caught with all of these kind of strange gadgets in the sense that, you know, higher tech equipment is easier to detect, actually, and follow, right? You have an iPhone, it can be detected. If you have a GPS, it can be detected. And so I wonder if this actually means that today's intelligence officers, intelligence gathering or espionage activities will actually become more low-tech rather than high-tech.
Well, I think it probably depends a great deal on the setting. You know, I think in the case of the Russians and the U.S., they each knows what the other is doing, I think, to a very substantial extent.
Well, I think it'll be interesting to see how this develops, as you mentioned, particularly in how the U.S.-Russian relations are affected, if at all, in this situation. Well, let's move on to another case in Europe, and that is signs this week that Europe's recession is deepening, but not necessarily any signs that the EU is taking any steps to really stimulate any growth. What is going on here, Mitchell? This is your area of the world. This is what you know best. What has Europe already tried to do, and is it not working?
Well, I think it's very clear. It's become almost universally recognized now that that austerity has generated not only economic problems but serious, very serious political tensions. I actually think the political problems that a number of European countries are experiencing are even more – potentially more worrisome than the economic problems, even though the economic problems themselves are certainly serious. I also think that there's a tension here because – the Eurozone countries have, at least for the time being, allayed some of the concerns of financial markets, and they don't want to stir things up and start another sort of run-up of a financial crisis.
Well, it's interesting that you say that the political problems are almost now more concerning than the economic problems. I mean, it really seems like Europe, the European Union, has kind of been paralyzed by this. You know, they've focused on the debt crisis. They've attempted austerity measures, you know, trying to bail people out. But this has grown to the extent that now they can't manage politically. I mean, what does this mean for the future of the European Union?
Well, I think that, you know, one has to look at the larger picture. There are many measures that the European Union has taken to deal with some of their difficulties, and they've come to a point where domestic politics, as usual, is getting in the way of advances toward deeper integration, such as banking union in particular, that might resolve some of these issues. It's widely recognized that this needs to be accomplished, but there are domestic political obstacles to undertaking the steps to achieve it.
Yeah, well, for sure. I mean, what about the connection between the European Union and the United States? How is this deepening crisis affecting, if at all, the relationship with the U.S.? I mean, our economies are so intertwined. Is this good for the U.S. economy or not?
No, clearly it's not good for the U.S. economy. And I think, in fact, it's remarkable. As difficult as times are in the United States, the conditions here are, you know, a picnic compared to what many European countries and Eurozone countries are experiencing, even some of the richer ones like France, for example. And so I think that American economic performance, in fact, has been quite remarkable in light of the difficulties that Europe is experiencing.
Well, thank you very much, Mitchell Smith, for joining me this week on World Views and sharing your insight.
Thank you.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about this show or answer any questions you may have. Write to us at worldviews@ou.edu or send us a tweet at worldviewskgou. Coming up, Joshua Landis and I continue our series of conversations about cultural diplomacy with author and veteran diplomat Richard Arndt. He's the author of the 2005 book, The First Resort of Kings, that argues that over the last five decades, U.S. cultural diplomacy programs have been devalued to little more than public relations campaigning. I'm Suzette Rolat, and you're listening to World Views. This is World Views. I'm Suzette Rolat. Our guest today is Richard Arndt, a veteran U.S. diplomat and the author of The First Resort of Kings, American Cultural Diplomacy in the 20th Century. He started his career with the United States Information Agency in 1961 and later worked as a cultural attaché in Lebanon, Iran, and Sri Lanka. He now serves as the co-chair of the Advisory Council for Americans for UNESCO and leads the U.S. Steering Committee for the Fulbright Association. Dr. Richard Arndt, welcome to World Views.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, you are the author of The First Resort of Kings, about cultural diplomacy in the United States. Can you tell us, first of all, what is that? What is cultural diplomacy? I'm not really sure there's a lot of agreement or even understanding about what that term even means.
You're one of the few people who recognizes that, Dean Gallup. It's a fact that nobody understands what – when I say I do cultural diplomacy, people say, what is that? So I say the Fulbright program and so forth. It stands to reason that between any two nations, there are a whole set of relations. Some of them are more easily measured and run through foreign ministries and so forth. But there are a lot of other things that happen, such as, for example, tourism, intermarriage. We look at each other's films. We go to each other's universities. We do all kinds of things that are a context of an intellectual and therefore cultural nature. Cultural diplomacy, by the way, is misnamed. It should be educational and cultural diplomacy. And it's, I would say, probably 60%, 70% education. And most of that is the Fulbright program. That is, the exchange between nations and by and large from university to universities of students and professors and researchers and so forth. Whereas culture sometimes falls into the into the division of what's called – what I call arts diplomacy in order to break us out of that definition. And I want to just say one thing about the word culture. The anthropologists have taught us that culture is the word we use to define why one group of people differs from another. The characteristics of people who eat spaghetti are different from those who eat largely fish and shrimp. And so when we say cultural diplomacy, we mean all of that area of human intellect and human activity which do not fall into political and economics.
So, I mean, you spent a number of years working at the U.S. Information Agency when it existed. So what is the difference between somebody who's providing information and somebody who's sharing culture? I guess you refer to them as informationists versus culturalists. Is there a difference there, or are they pretty much doing the same thing?
That's what USIA used to say. We do the same thing. And they wanted to pretend that U.S. information officers were the same as cultural officers and one could do the other. But in fact, information we all know about. We read it in the newspapers every morning. We see it on TV. Information is information. And culture is something else. What I mean by culture is what distinguishes my mind or your mind from that of someone in the Soviet Union doing the same thing at the same time.
It's propaganda. Information has to do with
information,
propaganda.
If it is used by power, can become and normally does become propaganda because it is used to support power and therefore to some extent the information is distorted. We like to believe that educational and cultural diplomacy does not require that kind of distortion, that you can exchange people and that they can be themselves and discover themselves as new people indeed and discover each other without necessarily distorting the truth in the process. Therefore, the investment of a cultural diplomat ranges in the range of perhaps 20 years or so for a person to mature and become who they're going to be and make their contribution to the world. Whereas an information officer is aiming to change someone's attitude by and large today for something that may happen tomorrow.
As you've watched America try to influence the world and influence the world even without trying, what are some of the very high points in the last 50 years?
I spent 5 years in Iran. In 1962 or three, the United States had decided it no longer needed to be the tutelary power, and it was time to turn things over to the Iranian government. They cut off AID, and they did it in a very gentle way. We call it phasing out, and they phased out AID, and that was very fine. There were a lot of things left over, however. AID had a couple of programs that they wanted to keep on. For example, a program to send Iranian students to the AUB, the American University of Beirut. And so that they put into my office. And that gave me a rather larger reach than most cultural officers. So for the next 5 years, I participated with the tools that I had in my hand, which is to say exchanges, sending people to the United States at various levels of educational development, with books, with theater, with movies, films, with all kinds of things, books, I said, and translations, English teaching, for example, all of those tools to try to help Iran keep moving in the direction that she'd been moving since the Mossadegh era. And moving towards a broader middle class, a middle class that was in control of the government, a government which was more responsive to the needs of people and to the middle class themselves, participatory democracy, if you like. And so for 5 years, I had the impression that we, my little office, through a whole variety of tools that we happened to have in our hands, were applying them to the growth of Iran as a decent and relevant and cooperative partner with the United States in a project to better the life for its citizens and its relevance to the world affairs around it and its role in the affairs of the Middle East.
We're speaking with Richard Arndt, the author of The First Resort of Kings, American Cultural Diplomacy in the 20th Century. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. I'm Suzette Grelot, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews on KGOU. I'm Suzette Grelot, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Joshua Landis and I are speaking with Richard Arndt, a veteran diplomat and the author of The First Resort of Kings, American Cultural Diplomacy in the 20th Century. Are some countries better at cultural diplomacy than we are? I mean, we have a long history. I mean, your book is, you know, lays this out very well. We have a long history in these types of relations, but do we, are we as good at it as we used to be? And are there other countries that are much better at it now than we are? The European Union, for example.
Yeah, there are a lot of definitions involved here, but I'll make it about as simple as I can. The French kind of invented this. So they started doing it long before we did. The French started because they sent Jesuits out in the 17th century, including to Iran, to Lebanon. And there it was. They started through their Jesuit brethren, where by and large a Jesuit stood to the left hand of almost every ambassador in a foreign country in those days, advising the ambassadors to what to do. So they got very good at it in a certain way. And the other thing that the French had was that they were a single state which controlled the whole education system and the whole production of cultural goods, you might say. The British were a little bit more nervous about it. The British saw cultural diplomacy largely as a tool of empire. They wanted to train cadres for their civil service, and so they trained them to be good little British civil servants. And that was very useful and very, very productive and produced some very fine things because they threw in the law as one of the things. Justice was something that the British left behind. When the Americans came on the scene very, very late, we were very good at it. Why? Because we'd never done it. That is to say, we'd never done it through government. But from the beginning, Americans reached out, starting with the missionaries, starting with the citizen diplomats. You recall that we had no professional diplomats until 1924. They were all friends of the president, political appointments, if you like. But when we talk about people like James Russell Lowell and Nathaniel Hawthorne and Bret Hart and W.D. Howells and people like that serving as ambassadors or consuls overseas, you understand that we were sending our best out to do something. Another class that helped us was the merchants. The merchants were very enlightened in their early days. It's not that they were making less money. They were just better at it than the Europeans were because the Europeans had come with a certain amount of entitlement and arrogance. And whereas we were sort of supplicants trying to strike better deals. And another class then finally emerged, believe it or not, is the military. The military in the 19th century played an astonishing role in cultural diplomacy, in spreading in science. For example, in Egypt, for example, the Americans, private Americans left over after the Civil War was over, went in and modernized the Egyptian army way back in 1870. One man was the head of the chief of staff of the whole Egyptian army. Another man mapped the southern border with Libya, and so forth. It goes on throughout the century. There were all kinds of things. So in the 19th century, Americans were doing this all the time, but the government had nothing to do with it. Once we decided to do it in 1617, when George Creel set up the Committee on Public Information, as a propaganda device for the First World War, he hired a bunch of academics, and the academics went out to the field, the professors went out to the field, and they didn't do what anybody told them. They did what they thought was best. And that was very good stuff because they were projecting the United States as the way we were.
So academics were some of the first cultural diplomats?
Absolutely. When the whole thing then opened up, the French formalized it in 23. The British formalized it in 34. We didn't formalize it until 38. The war came along with Pearl Harbor in 1941, December. By January 42, we were looking for cultural attachés, mainly for Latin America, but also for China, for Spain, for Turkey, Delhi and a few other countries. And every single person hired was off a campus. They were – guess why? Because they spoke the language. It's as simple as that. They spoke the necessary language to get them going. So they were all academics in the first days. After that, then, of course, the struggle of the propagandists to take over the cultural field for themselves and make it part of their program, which is now called public diplomacy, was a long one. But it still is a tug of war between people who want to project long-range truths and those who want to project short-term useful truths, let's call it.
Let me ask you about the difficulty today. Americans are closing themselves in big fortress embassies. And we've just gone through the assassination of an ambassador in Libya and the terrible problems that this proposes, because in many ways self-defense and security has become of the highest order in trying to build embassies, design them. Members of our foreign service cannot go out into the open in many states and mingle with the people. Maybe that's not so important. Maybe diplomacy, public diplomacy is taking place in other ways rather than through the State Department. I don't know. How do you see that? And how do you see the mission of public diplomacy changing due to this extraordinary security environment that where Americans are frightened to go? We, as you know, as a university at University of Oklahoma, trying to get students to the Middle East, we can almost not send them to any country, because the security environment and the State Department says you shouldn't send the students, and our lawyers here say you can't send them. And so we're almost locked out of education. We can't get foreign students to come to our universities. I mean, all these great things you've been talking about, education, they're coming to a screeching halt.
It's hard to answer the question because you've already answered it.
Well,
you've pointed out what the problems are and what causes them, and it's difficult to see how those causes can be alleviated, or certainly not eliminated in the near future. Let's take the case of embassies. I have a whole half chapter on the building of embassies. There was a time when we said we have to build the most beautiful embassies we can build, and we've got to get our best architects to do them, to exhibit the open, free nature of American life. It was called the American style of architecture, and we produced some very beautiful embassies. But today they're fortresses, as you say. So we have that kind of a problem. The problem of access to walking out in the streets. Can you imagine walking out from the green zone in Baghdad and taking a little stroll down the street talking to the locals in Baghdad? I can't imagine it. I don't think anybody would be mad enough to do that. So the styles of public diplomacy are now constrained by our fear, which after all is what terrorists try to produce, and which they've amply succeeded in. It's constrained by our fear of all kinds of violent things that are not very happy. Now, I don't know what we do about it except try to rebuild some kind of trust between nations whereby we can feel free to walk in each other's streets without feeling threatened. I suppose in some way we have that problem at home here, but it's not quite as advanced. It's not quite as dangerous. So that you've raised a set of conditions which, of course, are there. It's very hard to conduct cultural diplomacy in my style in an area where you don't have a fairly peaceful and fairly secure setting in which to do so.
Well, very interesting. Dr. Arndt, thank you very much for exposing us to these very challenging issues we face today. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Invite me back some other time.
We look forward to it.
You've been listening to our conversation with Richard Arndt, a longtime diplomat and the author of The First Resort of Kings, American Cultural Diplomacy in the 20th Century. The views and opinions expressed this hour do not necessarily reflect those of the KGOU staff or its licensee, the University of Oklahoma. Brian Hardzinski produces and edits the show, and Mackenzie Samus prepared the research for this interview. Next week, Joshua Landis and I will be in Turkey on behalf of OU's College of International Studies, and we plan to broadcast Worldviews from Istanbul. For Mitchell Smith and Joshua Landis, I'm Suzette Grelott.